The first one is what I call prophetic perspective. I'm not the only person, many scholars do this, that the prophets see things that are way off in the distance. And I often use the example of where I am in the south part of an apartment, third floor. I can see Mount Rainier. I can see the Cascades. It's marvelous. But I see the Cascade Range, for instance, only in its broad outlines of its height and of its breadth. I do not have 3D. And I can't see how many foothills there are until you finally get there, you see. But I can see it from a person down in a plane up that way. That's the way the prophets don't have 3D. If I come in an airplane from Portland or something like that, or from the Midwest, and then I can see the hills, you know, from both sides, or the ranges and so forth. And so I've used this example, and it's been quite good for my students, that if a prophet, let's say like Amos or Isaiah or Jeremiah, one of the pre-exilic prophets, saw the future, they really saw everything all at one time. They saw, for instance, not only, let's take for instance, Isaiah or Amos, that under the good King Hezekiah from the line of David, things would get better. They thought maybe he was the Messiah. Then when the Reformation came in Josiah, and they thought maybe he. They also asked the question, art thou he that should come, or do we look for another? And so they were describing, however, also the coming of Jesus, or what we would call the coming of Jesus, describing Ralph Gerke and you guys too in 1991, and he's describing the good things that happened way to the end of time. Do you see that? It's all there. It's almost like an arrow that is shot in a trajectory, and it intersects with various people at various times. And so therefore, you could say Ezekiel, in answer to your question, he is seeing, when he talks about Gog from Magog, and the final battle, and the final attack, he is seeing the final great victory of God over against them. And now, to put when that time is, because after Jesus, there are a lot of good things that have been happening in the New Testament era, there are bad things too, and I'll tell you that same when you look down. But and history hasn't wound up yet, and so we can expect a lot of things to happen. And I can't put it on a, in a sense, I've got a timeline here, and there is a future, but I can't put a date line on it. You see that, and only schematic. And you
could almost. Well, my question sort of was. When Jesus comes or before Jesus comes.
Yes, okay. I'll put that in the second pattern. Is that okay? Yeah, you're asking really the right questions. My diagram, and this is, I have a patent on this in Washington, D.C., is that the prophets not only saw good things, if I had red, I would put this in red, but there's no red color here. But they also saw bad things. They saw Amos and Isaiah, for instance, they saw that the Assyrians were going to come. And this was Tiglath-Pileser. Then they saw that Sennacherib was going to come, or the Babylonians were going to come. And then they saw the evil that would come when the Persians would come. And then they saw the evil that would come when Alexander successors the Greeks, especially the Old Testament Antichrist, would come. And then, of course, they expected that God would fulfill his promises. They also saw terrible things. You remember at the time, well, Jesus talks about the end of the world, a whole chapter in Mark 13. And certainly bad things have happened to us too. So you could have a history, if you wanted to, if you could look down the ground of evil things. And isn't this true that in Christian theology, that the last day is the day of redemption and it's the day of damnation too, isn't it? It's Judgment Day, and come ye blessed of my Father, and inherit the kingdom prepared for you, and then depart into everlasting fire prepared for the devil and his angels. So that's one perspective. And if you have that perspective, you see that? It's where you're standing. You're not from a spaceship somewhere out there or something like that. That's a very modern perspective, but people standing on earth, you see that? And if we happen to be right here, then we have to kind of look back And we see it in a little different perspective than the prophet did. Now, a second thing, and this is what you're asking, how does this relate to the final coming of Jesus? That is kind of the two epoch, or I'd use the two age thing, but the New Age people have preempted that in such a way that it's irretrievable with all their cosmic ideas. And so I can't really put it in those terms. But let me give you a very good example. Well, first, I mentioned this last time, that when I was a boy, we had to learn not only the catechism, but Bible history. We never really studied the Bible before confirmation directly. You got a Bible on your confirmation day, and then you were supposed to begin to study it. But before that, you started with the catechism and a Bible history book. You had 50 stories of the Old Testament you had to know, and 50 of the New. And they really drilled that. And I remember that we had the one from Daniel, not from Daniel 7, but from Daniel 2, that you have the four medals of that great big colossus. The head is golden. That's Nebuchadnezzar, the Babylonians. And this is the dream of Nebuchadnezzar. Remember that? Then you have the silver breast. Then you have the belly of bronze. And then you have the iron legs and clay feet. And then comes the stone, which comes and knocks it. You remember that it collapses and disintegrates. And what happens to that stone not made with hand? It fills the whole earth. And that's the kingdom of God that takes place of these other kingdoms, see? Now, Daniel 7 has the same sort of thing, except it has animals. And they're all monsters. And what did Daniel see there? This is a very famous chapter. It's the basis of that guy Hal Lindsey that I talked about last time. You've got four successive kingdoms. The first one he sees, it's a vision, is a lion. Isn't that the king of the beasts? But he tries to have intelligence of a human. He tries to stand up, but he can't quite make it. And finally, his place is taken by a bear. And the bear is a very, very ferocious bear. It has ribs in its teeth, and it's been getting after everything else. It's ungainly like a bear. Who can get it? It's another monster, see? The next one is a leopard, and it really is fast, and no time fast, it's caught everybody. And the last one is so terrible, it has iron teeth, it's such a monster you can't even describe it in human terms. It's really a monstrosity. And that's the kingdom, the last gate. Then comes what? The Ancient of Days. That means God, has a real radical break here. That's what you're talking about. And he sets up the thrones, and they have all the books of what people have done, and they read it, and they have a judgment. You see, that's Judgment Day. And then the kingdom is given to one who is like a human. And this is a really Aramaic, Son of Man. In the new revised RSV, the new RSV, they call it the man who is the human one. You see that? These are all bestial ones, and this is human. But the actual title is Baranash, Son of Man. And you know, it was used, Jesus sometimes uses it, and it's used as a title, rather important. And he comes, and to him then is given the kingdom. Now, notice what's happening here. Instead of having a continuity, as you would have in prophetic perspective, you've got this radical break between the old and new age. Chris Rutman was here, and he was asking, what about this? Do the prophets always, when they were talking about judgment, is it that each deed has its own judgment? If you do evil, it has its own reward. Don't you have interference? And I said, from the outside, it depends upon what pattern you have. And certainly in this one, God stops history. You see, that's the end of the world and of the old epoch, and then the new epoch comes in, see? Now, that's a pattern that perhaps now comes the interpretation, which you're interested in, and I am interested in that too. So why don't I just keep this thing a little clear here, put this down here. Jews let's not talk about present-day Jews, but let's just take its meaning in the Old Testament. In other words, pre-Christian, Old Testament. then we'll take the Christian idea. It's quite clear that in the dreams, in chapter 2 and 7, that the first kingdom is Nebuchadnezzar, who had the dreams, and Babylon. That's quite clear. The others are not identified, but from a lot of evidence in the book of Daniel and elsewhere, this seems to be the Medes, a group of people in the mountains of now Iran, and these, the Persians, they were kind of connected together, and then the time of the Greeks, Alexander and his successors, including the Old Testament Antichrist, Antiochus Epiphanes, and at his time, there was a radical break, and the people, the Maccabees, expected that this would be the end. And then all of a sudden, God would take over. Now, it actually didn't happen, so he had to update this, you see that? Now, there are two ways of Christian updating this. If you are a Christian, of course, you're going to have to see the fulfillment of Christ. This here ends without Jesus in here. You can't put the cross in it. So how have Christians done that? They've done it in two ways, and this is just to answer your question, that they have kind of said, well, yes, this is Babylon. This is the way my pastor taught us. And that's the way it was in the Bible history books. They had little notes on that. And then they put the Medes and the Persians together as the second kingdom because they were very closely allied. See, they came from the same region and were culturally very much. Then they put the Greeks here as the third kingdom, Alexander and his successors. And then they said, see, at the time of Romans, that's when Jesus came. Do you see that? And so this is kind of on a timeline. Do you see what I mean? A Christian timeline, putting it here. My pastor, however, boy, he really gave it to us on a lot of stuff. We had to memorize that the right hand of God was everywhere. And it took us years. I think it took me years to understand what he meant. He meant that if Jesus goes to the right hand of God, then he is everywhere. He's not bound to one place at one time. He was trying to get the Lord's Supper straight to us, but you know how hard that is to understand that he can be everywhere at all times, is not bound, you see that, since the resurrection. But what he gave to us is that we are in the millennium. He didn't like those people who are talking about the millennium, you see that? And he said the 1,000 years of Revelation 12, the millennium, the good age, began already partway in the midst of the old age. So, and I think this wasn't too bad. You had the evil world out here, but you also had the church. He was a real churchman. And the millennium had begun, and then we were going to wait for the final coming of Jesus in glory. That's what you're asking about. And so his coming, his advent, the final advent, is here after the resurrection, and this is kind of the way in which that'll be the end of the world, his coming in glory. There is another way of doing it, and that having a premillennialist. They do the same sort of thing, except this is what they do, like dispensationalists. You may have heard of the whole lot of people in the Assembly of God and those people today. There are quite a few of them. They're various. They will say Rome and its successors. And they simply say it this way, that Christ is going to come, and they are premillennialists, and then the millennium will come. Now, I think you can be a Christian and take any one of these versions here. You somehow have to put Christ in here. Do you see that? And his coming in the flesh and then his final coming. Our pastor also got after us too, especially we had to go to church in Advent, even on Wednesday evenings, not only on Lent. And he said it's not only what everybody talks about, the first and second coming. He didn't like that. He said, you've got to have three comings. His first coming, his last coming, and then his coming all the time in between, in word and sacrament, where you have to be. You know how that was. They had told you what to do in those days. And so that was his way of doing it. And I think that was legitimate. and Zilla Zuma. But then I mentioned that I happen to be personally, as a scholar, an amillennialist. I don't put it in the timeline. And therefore, I simply think that the easiest way to simply put it down is to simply say that basically, I better get a good, this gets dry once you have exposed it. The old epoch, the old evil epoch, is one in which we live. But since the coming of Christ, we also live in the good new epoch. And we live at the intersection of the two. You see that we live both in the old and new. And here I have to thank to my grandpa. My grandpa died when I was only 8 years old, but I stayed often with my grandparents. He taught me that whole business of the old Adam. First, I thought it was Adam Smith who lived down the road. You know, our old nature and then our new nature. Somehow, I don't know how a grandpa can do that, you know? And you're still a young person. And that we are in both. And so I would put a cross here, not only because it's an empty cross, but I'd also put a cross here because it's the old age and the new age. I'd put it in both colors if you want to use a symbolism, that we live in both. And that's why I mentioned in a sermon the other night that catcher on the PLU baseball team was right when he said Christ the Crucified means the guy who's torn apart between the two epochs. You see that? And you notice here I don't have any time. And so if you ask me time, I'd say, well, and we had some really good questions last time. For me personally, maybe sacramentally, I got into this new age sacramentally through the Holy Spirit and baptism. But I had to finally say yes myself in confirmation, you see that? Yeah. And finally, many, many times I have to say yes and hear the gospel. I can fall back into the old age. And then the wonderful question, she's not here, she's in dish duty, but she asked the question, when are you entirely free in the new age? And I said, when you die. Or when you come to the resurrection, you see that? Now, that means something personally. And now if you ask me, what about the ongoing history of the world? Yes, I think the history of the world will finally come. We have signs of the coming advent of Christ, the kingdom. And in the text study, when Scott was having text study for a couple Sundays ago, I shocked the people, I guess, and maybe him, by saying, well, I think maybe capitalism is a sign of the coming of the kingdom, despite all of its difficulties, because it's produced a lot of wealth in the country. Or democracy, the freedom of people. We were talking about freedom and democracy. And you can have your own ideas. How God is doing this and when it will do or when it will come, I have no idea. So I only speak of signs of the kingdom. Do you see that?
Well, but in reading Ezekiel, it tells about I am your God and you are my children to the Israelites. And the Israelites, we've seen them struggle for so many years.
Oh,
and
yes.
Are we going to see them free in their own country before?
Well, here is quite a different, they will still have to follow a variation of this pre-Christian idea from Daniel, you see that? And they'll update it, and they will. Somehow, as Christians, we'll have to put Christ in, or we're no longer Christians, you see that? So all I'm having down here is Christian. I think what you're saying, though, is good, that we should try to understand people on their own terms. We should try to understand Muslims. Alpha is telling us that we're supposed to try to find the Mayans as God's creatures on their own terms, you see that? And history is not wound up yet. And even where we're in the midst of a very strong tradition, where when we come to worship, the first thing we have is listen to the scriptures, isn't it, of what happened before, we don't understand everything. I quoted this last time from Isaiah 45, where finally the prophet, after he hears about how they're going to go to exile and punished for this sin, and then finally be brought back, something like Ezekiel, he says, thou art a God that hidest thyself, just in marvel. We wouldn't have known that that's the way it's going to happen. You see that? Who would have thought that through exile? One of my teachers, George Knight, who's been teaching in the Fiji Islands, out where you guys have been, in a seminary out there, he simply said that Israel was crucified under Nebuchadnezzar and buried in Babylon and raised by Cyrus. And that's kind of looking at from the Old Testament viewpoint to see that, well, partly New Testament. But as I mentioned many times here, the difference between us and the Jews is that we believe that the Messiah has already come. So this is, the New Age is here. They would expect that age to come. Now, if you ask what's going to happen then on Judgment Day, well, just go to Matthew 25, and that's good enough for all people, including Muslims, and all nations will be gathered. You see that? And we can't. Meanwhile, I suppose for Jews, they are waiting for the coming Messiah. There's no question about that. So if you have been in an inter-Jewish talks, and I would encourage you to be in on that. It does not, the interfaith dialogue, if you're honest and don't try to compromise, in which each tradition, the Jews being genuine Jews and the Christians being genuine Jews, you get quite farther than you can imagine. Well, one more footnote. When I was in seminary, and I went to a very strict conservative seminary, Wisconsin Synod in Thiensville, Wisconsin, we were shocked by our professor, who came with Latin quotations from the old dogmaticians, that Jews could be saved. And we wondered, how can that be? And he said, and he had the quotations, and the old theologians had said, if they believe the promises of the coming Messiah, even though they don't know that he's come, then they are justified by their faith as much as Christians who believe that he has come. And that's rather shocking, isn't it?
Where is that written?
I think that I can't tell you the exact page or anything like that. Hullett was the name of the dogmatician. It was a Lutheran scholar, you know what I mean? Like, we have a lot of theologians. It's not written in the scriptures, you see that? That was his opinion, and you're not bound to ignore. And I know, as I said, it shocked us, you see that? But it's one of those things that if you've got a kind of a kooky professor, and he was a Dr. aus Deutschland from Leipzig, and he just knew that maybe we were being very exclusive, you see that?
Yeah.
And he wanted to have, without losing Orthodox background and saying simply makes no difference between Christianity or anything else, he was kind of making us face up to that. Now we're leaving Ezekiel by and we're talking about the end of the world.
Well,
but we don't have so much to do today, so let's just keep on for a minute here yet.
Is it Buzzcon?
Pardon?
That his last name's Khan, and he's over in Bellevue, or...
Buzzcon.
Yes, I've heard of that person. I've never met him.
Okay, he's a Jewish Christian.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But I went to one of his classes 2 years ago, and I think he was trying to convey this all along, that we are very exclusive, and that the Jews do not believe as we think they believe.
Mm-hmm. Yes. No, I think we have to get it from the horse's mouth. That's why when I was teaching all my years, from the first time when I realized what terrible things that had happened in Germany, and even though I wasn't there or anything, with our background of at least German Lutherans, I said, I will never teach the Old Testament without giving my students the opportunity and urging them to go to a Jewish synagogue. And I usually made arrangements, and that was very good. Let me give one more quotation that might help you in the back there. I did it once before. Martin Buber, who before the Nazis took over in Germany, was a great theologian in Germany and then went to Israel. And they had a lot of Christian-Jewish dialogues too. And then he finally said, well, the great difference between you Christians and us Jews is that you believe the Messiah has come, and we are still waiting for him. But you are still waiting for him, too, to come finally, to wrap it up. So we're very similar.
Mm-hmm.
And when he comes, you Christians ought to ask him, didn't we see you once before? Which is a very interesting thing. And then, this gets naughty here. Here I have some question marks. It continues, and the Messiah would be well advised to to respond, I don't remember. Which is pretty hard. That's saying more of the person of Christ than I want to say. That, at least of the risen Christ. Yes?
No, the reason that I mention it all is the Southern Baptists, they would argue that a person would have to profess Christ as their personal Savior or else not be saved, and that goes contrary to your statement there.
Yeah, well, I think you're kind of right. In a way, I like that, but I guess I would be a little more inclusive. I'm not one of these persons that everybody's going to be saved, you see that? Not at all. But if you take Matthew 25 very seriously, all nations will, if they haven't confronted him before that, they'll confront him then. And the basis of what? The kingdom that he has brought, you see that? And not just whether you are orthodox in your theology or what we're talking about here, or your biblical interpretation, on what you have done to the least of these, my brethren. And I think that's very, very deep in Christianity. And that means Christianity is not a universalism or something like that, but it has that inclusive rather than exclusive. See, the church has done it too, that if you weren't in the church, you were saved, you were damned, you see that? And here I think this is a very important passage. Now, of course, there are various interpretations, and I would listen to my fellow Christians at Southern Baptists on that, but I really wouldn't say, you guys got to turn or burn right now. I don't think that's very well-founded. Well, should we get to Ezekiel? I think this is really all I wanted to review, and maybe some of you missed that.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Now, we really don't only have to have some diagrams here today in order to see what Ezekiel says. Take out your Bibles. You always want to start with at least some Bible reading, although today we'll have to. We've got a half an hour, don't we, yet?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Some of you have only 15 minutes. That's too bad. But you'll have to listen to the tape. Why don't we start with the very first chapter 40, verse 1 to 4. Because it has a number of dates there, I'm going to read this myself first, if you don't mind. In the 25th year, by the way, that's important, it's half of 50 years. And you know what I think about numbers. They're significant. So half the time of the exile is gone, get the idea? That seems to be the idea. He gives the name, the first month, that was perhaps, if it was in the spring, Nisan, if it was in the fall, Tishri, the 10th day, kind of the New Year's Day. We call it April, they have the beginning in the spring, the new moon.
What's the reference again?
The pardon?
Chapter 40?
Yes, chapter 40, verse 1.
Verse 1, thank you.
Okay, I'll just reread it again. In the 25th year, the first month, the 10th day, we call that New Year's Day, April 28th, 573. So, didn't he have his important prophecies? He always has a law, doesn't he? Tells you when it is. And that's interesting. The hand of the Lord was upon me. Well, you know what that means, don't you? This is one of these visions again. Look at verse 2. We can't read everything. He brought me in the visions of God to the land of Israel and set me upon a very high mountain on which was a structure like a city opposite me. Here's a model. And if the model would be and you were a bird, this is what you would see. You would see a big wall around you. That's to keep the polluted people out. You can only get through special gates and going through certain mikvahs, washing yourself with waters and being clean. And you can get into the outer courtyard. But even then, you have to pass through these gates. And by the way, this one is closed and this one is closed. You can't get in there. This until Judgment Day is closed. Because the Lord went through here when he came back and into this temple. And that's why the Susa Gate in Jerusalem to this day, is blocked up. It's still blocked up. Some of you have been there. And then you get to the inner circle. And finally, then you get into the temple. And this is where he's finally going to show him the whole thing. And now you have this interpreting angel. Whenever you have this sort of two-epoch type of literature in the Bible, you'll see a vision, but you need a special divine guide to interpret it. And so look at here, verse 3. There was a man whose appearance was like bronze, with a line of flax, that's his measuring line, and a measuring reed in his hand, like we have a staff, don't we? Like in archaeology, you have these meter sticks, you see that? And you just measure things like that. Ordinarily, you measured by cubits. But these cubits here in Ezekiel are going to measurements. But so this guy is ready to measure. And by the way, all these measurements are symbolic. Sevens. And if it's not complete, it's only six. What's the number in the book of Revelation of the incomplete monster who is not the answer to everything? 666. Everybody asks, what is that? And, well, he's not 777. That's the whole idea. Well, here he has a measuring stick in his hand, verse 4. The man said to me, Son of man, look with your eyes and see and hear with your ears and set your mind on all that I'll show you. And behold, there was a wall all around the outside of the temple area. And I can't go into this. Here's that big wall that surrounds this. This is the precinct, we call that. And then inside of it, you're going to have an outer courtyard. Later in Herod's temple, it was the courtyard of the Gentiles. They could come that far, remember that? And then you had an inner courtyard. In Herod's temple, women could only come this far from the women's court, remember that? Ezekiel is better toward the women than King Herod was, and the later Jews, which is kind of surprising. And then inside of this, you had to be a real Orthodox Jew. Even here, there were priests on duty, and if you were unclean or something, you just couldn't get in there. Who shall ascend to the hill of the Lord? Who shall stand in his holy place? Who has a pure heart and a clean mind? Who has clean hands? Who hasn't lifted up his soul to vanity and all that? You couldn't just... See, our churches are public. In the old churches, you had to renew your baptism with holy water before you could get in. But even the Catholics don't always do that today, the old idea. But here, this was very, very strict. And if they investigated you and they found out that you weren't kosher, you had to go home and you had to clean up and go through all kinds of washings and all that sort of stuff. And then you have the temple arrangements. Well, let me just picture that. What are some of the temple arrangements here? In the inner courtyard, you had an altar. Well, that was in Solomon's temple, too. And then you have the temple building itself, and the temple has what? The holy place and then the Holy of Holies. And the Holy of Holies is a cube, and that's where the Lord sits on top of the ark. You see that? And so that's kind of described in the book of Exodus, but it's also done here. And Ezekiel does it in such a way that any loopholes that they still had in the first temple will be plugged up, but this place is going to be pollution free, and they'll be able to take care of it, and they'll make that more and more and more a holy place. And then there would be places here for the priest, kind of, we call it a sacristy, you see that, for putting on garments and all that, and then other places for the priests over here. And then since they had some sacrifices were with the barbecue, you had part of the meat. Do you see that? And where could you eat that? You could eat that out in the kitchens here. So he got the kitchens. And by the way, he puts it way far away here so it doesn't begin to get close here to polluting. You see that? It's a kind of a fence around the fence. That's really what he's seeing. And you can read this for yourself. We don't have time to go into all the details. Would you please look at chapter 43, verse 1. And now we're going to have something important. That he sees that the Lord, who had moved his presence out, we saw that in chapters 8, 9, 10, and 11. Do you remember that? Had left, is now going to return. The glory of the Lord is going to return. Look at chapter 43, verse 1. Afterward, he brought me to the gate facing east. So here's the eastern gate here. And this is the Mount of Olives, and that's the way out there in Babylon. And behold, the glory of the God of Israel came from the east. You remember, he had left it at the time of the destruction. Now he comes back. And notice what he does. He goes right straight through that gate. Nobody else can use that after that. And he can go right through this gate here
And he can come back here, and what is he going to do? He's going to put his presence. And that's almost like a radiation, and it's beneficent. When you went to the temple, you didn't just go to the here with your ears. You went there to eat and to drink the sacrifices, and you had received the God's blessing. And it was really physical. You know, that old pastor we had, he wasn't so old. He said, you people leave the church. First of all, you don't go to communion, but then you leave the church before before you get the blessing. And he was really rather strict that you had to receive the blessing physically from the pastor at the end of the service. And then you could go out in peace. And that's Old Testament. There's no question about that. He studied his Bible. And so here what happens, verse 4. Well, verse 2 said, behold, the glory of the God of Israel came from the east. Look at verse 4. As the glory of God entered the temple precinct by the gate facing the east, the Spirit lifted me up and brought me into the inner courtyard. So here he's lifted up and he stands right here. And now he can be where he was when he was an apprentice priest as a young boy. And he saw the glory of God entering the temple. And the glory of God filled the temple. Verse 6. By the way, when Solomon dedicated the temple, and the glory of God filled the first temple, it was so powerful that Solomon couldn't go inside. They were afraid to go inside. Do you know that when the high priest, on the Day of Atonement, in Herod's temple, we know that, went inside of here, they were afraid that he would never come out. So they put a rope around him. So that if they had to pull a dead body out there, it was polluted, they could pull it. And it had little tinkling bells on the side, and they would hear it, and they would say, oh, he's still alive. Because on that day, great day of Yom Kippur, he had to take the blood of the sacrifice and put it on the mercy seat. You see that? So try to get the idea that this is reality, greater reality. Well, the same reality that we have, closest thing we can have, is the real presence of our Lord in the sacrament. When he comes with all of his blessing as the Lord of heaven and earth, right down here where we are. And I think that's what you have here. Well, 6b. While a man, you know, that's an interpreting angel, was his guide, standing beside me, I heard one speaking to me out of the temple. And he said to me, Son of man, this is the place of my throne and the place of the soles of my feet. Does God have feet? He sure does in the Old Testament. And where I will dwell in the midst of the people of Israel forever, and the house of Israel shall no more defile my holy name. This place is got pollution free. Do you remember the old time he saw all kinds of wicked things that were happening? He had one stone here that had been part of a heathen altar. You remember that? The stone of jealousy, and they had all kinds of people doing wrong things. This place is going to be pollution free. and that's the idea. Let them put away their idolatry and the dead bodies of the kings far from me. You know, the kings, this is a terrible archaeological fact, that underneath the Dome of the Rock, you can go there yourself. This is a terrible thing for Orthodox Jews. They argue against it, but you can't. You can go underneath there. In the time of Herod, it's where all the blood from the sacrifice went down to the sewer. And there was plenty of it when you had a big Passover. Archaeologists have said those were originally Middle Bronze Age Canaanite tombs. Dead. Now, you have to have a lot of holy water to sprinkle that on. But the book of Leviticus tells you how to purify things from dead. So I think the Supreme Court of Israel will take care of that. See, that's if they build up what? The third temple there. Don't you think the rabbis in Israel are studying this like mad these days? They're getting all this stuff ready. So let them put away their idolatry and the dead bodies of the kings far from me, and I'll dwell in their midst forever. And you, Son of Man, describe the temple, that they may be ashamed of their iniquity. You see, Ezekiel is still kicking him in the shins, that they've got to behave and obey. Verse 44, we have now this tour. So he brought me to the outer gate of the sanctuary that faces east, and he said, this is the gate. And then, I can't go through all this. He describes the gate in all kinds of detail,
And he has all of, who can be admitted to this inner court? You see that? You have all the rules here. Then the responsibility of the priests, what each priest has to do. Then you've got a prince, and we're surprised to hear of a prince. He's kind of the secular ruler. He's not quite a Messiah, but sometimes later they call him the Messiah. The people at Qumran called him the Messiah of David, and they called the other one the Messiah of Aaron, the prince. They had two anointed people. See, the word Mashiach means one who is anointed with the holy oil. And they anointed a king, they also anointed a priest, you see that? And here he's called a prince. We don't know much about that. But he must have expected somebody from David's line that would kind of come back like Zerubbabel. And it's got worship. He has an awful lot about those temple kitchens and how you have to keep everything clean in those temple kitchens in the corner. And then the temple precincts are described all the way. I don't think we can go through all of that. It's just too much. You see, you've got regular priests from Aaron's line. Then you've got Levites, that second-class priest. They can't shed blood. They can't do the big things. You see, blood shedding, a lot of people don't know, that's like a detergent. You have to have the shedding of blood, and the detergent simply takes away. The shedding of blood simply takes away the sin. And you've got to have that there. You can't just, it's a purificated. To us, we have a different idea of blood. You see that? We have modern conception. But we have to, if we want to understand the Bible on its own terms, we have to understand that that's where he'll have all these procedures. And it's got to be done clean. And only a first-class priest can do it. And now, B, do you mind reading for us? You haven't read here. In chapter 47, 1 and following, we'll have you read first verses 1 and 2. What happens to the big river that comes out of the temple?
Afterward, he brought me again unto the door of the house, and behold, waters issued out from under the threshold of the house eastward. For the forefront of the house stood toward the east, and the waters came down from the right side of the house, at the south side of the altar. Then brought he me out of the way of the gate northward, and led me about the way without unto the utter gate.
Yes, now notice what's happening. Underneath this is the threshold, isn't it, here of the temple? He sees water coming out. Don't you remember in the Garden of Eden what came out of that garden and flowed north, east, south, and west? Wasn't that a river that watered the whole garden and made it fruitful, even though it was kind of a desert oasis? And here he's saying the same thing. And notice now, it's flowing down underneath, and it's going down the Brook Kidron. And you know where it's going down? It's going down toward Qumran, and going to go to the Dead Sea. And you know what happens when this water gets to the Dead Sea? It makes the whole Dead Sea what?
Salty,
it's no longer salty. It's wonderful. You got fishermen down there in the Dead Sea. Now you can't have a living thing in it. And everything is glorious. You see this vision. That's the idea behind it, that this should come. And it was flowing. And so then he has to go around here, and he has to come here, and then finally he can see it. And if you don't mind, I'll read the next section here. Verse 3. Last part of it, the man measured 1,000 cubits. You know, he's got this cubit, 1, 2, 3, he counts 1,000. What, by the way, why is 1,000 an important number? Don't get me on numbers. Well, look at here, ladies and gentlemen. That's where our decimal system comes from. Yeah, 10. Isn't that how you count it all? Sure. So if 7 is the dimensions, top, bottom, front, back, right, left, and the seventh dimension, which is transcendent, beyond it, and also underneath it, 10 is like this. And so this is kind of in multiples of tens. So he measures, he goes along here on the Brook Kidron, 1,000 cubits, and he stops, and where's the water? Ankle deep. Verse 4, he measured 1,000 cubits, he led me through the water. It was up to its loins. Be careful. To his waist. And then verse 5, he measured 1,000. It was a river. Could not pass through it.
for the water had risen, was deep enough to swim in, a river that could not be passed through. And he said to me, verse 6, Son of man, have you seen this? Skip to verse 8. This water flows toward the eastern region and goes down to the Araba, that's that desert valley down there where the Dead Sea is. And when it enters the stagnant water of the Dead Sea, the water will become fresh. So everything will live where the river goes. And on the banks, on both sides of the river, there will grow all kinds of trees for food. Their leaves will not wither, nor their fruit fail. But they will bear fresh fruit every month. And so instead of one crop a year, you'll get one every month. Because the water from them flows from the sanctuary. Their fruit will be for food, and their leaves for healing. Where does this occur elsewhere in the Bible? In the New Jerusalem, at the end of the book of Revelation, when you've got all these beautiful, the tree of life, which has healing in its leaves, and all these sorts of things. That's where the seer, John, got this from, Ezekiel. Why do you all look so glum here? I'm wondering, is this the beginning of the new creation, the new heaven, the new earth? Sure it is. On earth. To crack a joke here, I was only once in my life ever given the opportunity to dedicate a church. I was in teaching at Concordia Teachers College in River Forest, Illinois. I was chairman of the department. And these people who were kind of maids and mechanics and helping the rich people north of Chicago, and a good share of them were Lutherans, you know, Danes and Swedes and Germans and people from the old country, but they were good cooks and all that. They had a little Lutheran church on the other side of the tracks, literally on the other side of the tracks. And they had a kooky pastor. But they loved him. And they finally got all their money together to build a new church. This was Missouri Synod. They were really good. But the pastor didn't like the way the Missouri Synod was going, and so he wouldn't ask the bishop to come. He asked Professor of Theology from River Forest. I never saw the man before or since, that I should come. And I said, what should I preach on? And I said, Ezekiel 47. And I can remember there was a kind of a hippie character in the middle of that church with his hair stringing all over. Whenever, it was always like the Baptist, Negro Baptist, whenever I'd say something important, you know, updating this to Christ, oh man, you know, it was great. I found out he was a pastor's son and one of these disc jockeys on that Chicago radio station. And a Valparaiso University, Lutheran University graduate, of all things. But it was great. And they celebrated the Lord's Supper, and it was one of the greatest days of my life. And this text, because it was so important that these people come to hear the Word of God and the sacrament, and they were faithful Christians. This was just a marvelous text, so I hope you don't mind my telling you some of the experiences. But you live with the Bible, don't you? You don't just read it once and then you have to live in this. And undoubtedly, if we had time, we would talk about other experiences here. Let's finish the last thing we've got to do, because I can't come back tomorrow. Now he's going to have the allocation in a new land. The land has to be there. And this is called, I don't think I have it right here, it's called the whole portion. Part of it is the city of Jerusalem here, but in this portion, see, he's got a tape measure and he's got everything all the way up to the borders of Lebanon and everything down to the borders of Sinai. He's got five tribes down here and seven tribes up there. This is what Menachem Begin and all those hardliners read every day, because they'd like to have all that land, you know. That's when they say Eretz Israel, they mean what? Everything we can take that's mentioned in the Bible, get the idea? So the present day United Nations boundaries don't mean anything. And if Bush thinks that he's going to solve this by having United Nations resolutions, you know, well, he'll learn a few things from those hardline Jews, and that's going to be very hard. So in the midst comes what's called the whole portion. And notice what's in the center, the temple, isn't it? And the Levites, second-class priests, they have a section,
And the other main priests, like Ezekiel himself, they have the middle portion. The prince has portions on either side. It's all divided up in little proportions. And here's the city. And the city is given the name, the City of God, because Yahweh dwells there. It is not really called Jerusalem anymore. It has a new name. God dwells there. Well, if we put this together with what we have here, and if we do really believe that the kingdom has already come in Jesus for Christians, it is wherever we hear the word of God, where two or three are gathered together in his name and speak the gospel. It doesn't have to be in the church, but I think the church can never get by without gathering together, especially for the meal that Jesus has. And it's kind of a foretaste, isn't it, of the kingdom? That's the way it is. And when it comes, I'm always teasing this gal who has left, but I'll talk to her anyway, that when it happens on a timeline is not that important, I think. Our individual lives are important, and when we hear the gospel, we have to live in time and space. But here is a marvelous thing of Ezekiel. Well, I hope you people will continue to study Ezekiel.
The journey that's important, right?
Pardon?
It's the journey that's important.
Yes, right. You're on the way. And yeah. And if you stop at any time and you say, you know, I've got it made or something like that.
Too bad.
Yeah. And I really like this, that Ezekiel is kind of open. And much more flexible than a lot of people think. And so it's like in the New Testament, whenever I hear St. Paul in church, I say, Ralph, you got to listen. You know, and there's a quotation or something. And I guess I do that. He isn't the greatest of the prophets. Isaiah is much greater for the history of salvation. But he helps, and we need people like that too. Well, thank you for your attention.
Thank you.
I'm sorry that if there's any unsettled things, please come and see me and I'll settle them right away.